concerns about, you know, where we stand right now. Where, what paragraph are we at right now?
I think we are in my book, page 710.
And the paragraph begins?
Descent and integration. Paragraph begins, for if we look not at the scientific or physical aspects, but not that paragraph, I think.
Right. Does everybody else think that it's the same paragraph? I think I show that same one, either that one or the next one, actually. I show that we completed that one.
Oh, we did.
I mean, I'm in that page, but I can't remember if we did this or we have to start here.
You remember, I discussed that special use he makes of that word agnostic over there.
Yeah, I see it here. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think we finished that paragraph. And I just wanted to bring us up to date on the main issues that we are at the point where we've reached here, that Sri Aurobindo is, you know, bringing to our attention the whole issue of consciousness in its evolution, in its ascension through grades of consciousness. Where we are right now, he has introduced the idea of the debate about whether this is a continuous ascension of consciousness, a continuous gradation of consciousness, or whether there are discontinuities or disruptions in this ascension. And if you remember, he has related it to, in passing, he has related it to the other major debate outside of his theory, so to say, which the rest of the world is concerned with, or the Western world at least is concerned with, regarding evolution, and that is what they call creationism versus evolution. So the creationism theory, which is espoused by people who follow the Bible in a sense, or who believe the Bible literally, is one that does not give any credence to an evolution of consciousness, and believes that each creature that appears in the world is already fully formed and made by God, molded by God, as it were, and plopped on the earth. Actually, in their sort of original version, all at once. In other words, there is no succession in time. Everything just appears, you know, like as in Noah and the Ark. So that's the whole creationism theory, while the whole idea of evolution is of a gradation of consciousness that's appearing. And he has discussed both these in brief in this the kind of paragraphs that have preceded this. With creationism, evidently there is a problem in that it doesn't seem to give any credence to the relationship between gradations of consciousness that have appeared or their historicity. And with the evolutionary theory, there is another problem, and he starts on that too, which is that the whole emphasis is on an evolution of forms adapting themselves to greater and greater possibilities of survival. And there is no acknowledgement of a root above, as it were, a root in consciousness. The root is in matter. And whatever is emerging is adapting itself to its life in matter through a greater and greater power of persistence. So, we have these two theories, and then the traditional or classical Darwinian theory believed in a very random process of strict gradualism. In other words, that mutations take place randomly, so that mutations exhaust themselves in a kind of breadth first manner, and from one stage to another, there is a kind of a tremendous proliferation of all the possibilities, and only some are empowered to survive because nature selects them for survival. So that is natural selection. But this gradual ascension leaves the problem of what are called the missing links behind. Always from species to species, there is a kind of a difficulty in discovering missing links, and also a difficulty in establishing how or why species branch off in very complex manners, not through just single mutations, but through classes of mutations. A whole class of mutations that differentiates species one from another. So this is actually given fuel to the creationists who say that the reason we don't find any missing links is because these creatures are fully formed and they just kind of arrive, as it were. There are no missing links. So Sri Aurobindo, in a way, though he takes care not to foreground these debates, is presenting his, you know, sort of observation of the ascension of species as one which is a ascension in grade, but also one which does present discontinuities. And he makes this very obvious by pointing to the fact that Darwinian evolution focuses on the evolution of forms, but it totally neglects or ignores the evolution of consciousness. And if we look at the evolution of consciousness, then we see that very distinct changes in consciousness take place once a certain set of organs have been adapted to the expression of new forms or modalities of consciousness. The modality of inanimate matter and the modality of life as a form of being and consciousness is very radically different. The set of properties are very radically different. Again, the jump from life to mind, it's a totally different modality of being and consciousness. An animal would never be able to imagine what embodied mental beings experience. In a similar way, human beings can never imagine what an embodied supramental being will experience as its normal experience, as its species property of experience. So that radical difference in consciousness gives a certain credence to the disruptions between species, the fact that there are these kind of discontinuities in the emergence of consciousness. On the other hand, we do find that in in this movement upwards, the adaptation of physical forms to higher and higher forms of consciousness allow these four higher forms of consciousness to express or manifest in lower forms, and then to take up the lower form into a higher functioning of consciousness. So there is a certain kind of cross-linking, one may say, and this cross-linking is evidence for a certain form of evolution that's taking place, a certain kind of continuity that exists somewhere that is working in a discontinuous fashion in this particular evolving ignorance, as Sri Aurobindo calls it. So this is the debate, as Sri Aurobindo, this is the kind of trend or movement of evolution that Sri Aurobindo has introduced where we are right now.
The question is this is Shyam here. Could you repeat the last part of how not foregrounding the evolution of forms and by foregrounding the evolution of consciousness, the discontinuities are explained in Sri Aurobindo? Could you just repeat that last few sentences again? I think I just lost you.
Yeah. No, actually, there also one has to, it's very interesting because when Sri Aurobindo is writing this, The whole idea about punctuated equilibrium is very far away from the scene. Punctuated equilibrium is a sort of a theory of evolution proposed by Stephen Jay Gould,
Yeah.
probably in the 80s, the mid-80s, 1980s. And it arises from a study of the fossil records. And it also tries to explain these missing links. But the Darwinian theory was one of a purely random process, because if you don't have any ground in consciousness, if you are assuming only matter and material processes as the basis of all evolution, then you cannot say that the dice is loaded in any way. The dice cannot be loaded. It can only be a random set of mutations that occurs from any standard base. And these random set of mutations have to be all the possible mutations that can occur. Out of these, certain mutations are going to be empowered, because the others are accidents that basically cause freaks and nature weeds them out because they can't survive. But of all the various kinds that can survive, we should be able to see such a tremendous gradual slope from the, you know, from any particular base, species base, to a higher base. I mean, we're using the term higher over here already. That presupposes a kind of a consciousness explanation. But in Darwinian theory, there wouldn't be any question of higher. There would be a question of increased complexity and increased adaptation to nature. So in that sense, we should be able to see, based on purely material processes, a very gradual sort of, you know, a field of evolutionary mutations leading ultimately to new species that, you know, sort of survive because they're adapted better. But the fossil records should be able to show us enough evidence of all those other mutations that did not manage to survive. All those mutations that managed to, and there should be many other mutations that did manage to survive, but were probably not as well adapted as the ones that we are familiar with. This should be natural to a totally random material evolution, a materialistic evolution. But this is not the case, and evolutionary theorists have been plagued by trying to explain the lack of these so-called missing links. Now, what Sri Aurobindo is saying is that that lack of missing links, if we look at it from a consciousness point of view, it is evident that there are total discontinuities in the modality of being and consciousness that are appearing in this creation. And, you know, kind of a rudimentary, I mean, I think the paragraph we'll read, he'll go into greater detail about that, that, you know, rudimentary sort of nerves or nervous systems make their appearance in the animal creation, and then a sort of a sensory organization develops out of that, and a brain develops out of that, but still, there isn't a full degree of functioning of rationality in the animal kingdom. It is as if the life principle in matter is forming through its mutations certain instruments which mind can use, but these instruments are not fully sort of adapted to completely allowing a new principle to act. And it is only when the new principle takes up whatever has been developed to an adequate degree, an approximation that is close enough, that there is a sudden jump. And this is the point he's making about the sort of missing links being really an evidence of the fact that consciousness is taking leaps in its process of evolution. And also, he will therefore suggest that it is not only an ascension by random processes from below, but also an intervention from above that is involved in the entire process.
And does that also, in a way, presuppose that when the life principle is beginning its is beginning the steps of evolving those organs, which will afterward be used up by the mind, there is some kind of an intelligence in that life principle that it's knowing what it has to do for before the next principle can come and take over?
Yes, that is the whole theory of the involution of higher grades of consciousness, of the involution of the entire gradation, infinite gradation of consciousness in matter, matter being just an objectification or another kind of act of viewing by consciousness of that which alone is, in other words, Brahman, with all its gradations of consciousness. Matter is another name for Brahman, and the entirety of Brahman is involved in matter. But in its emergence, since it has been put into a kind of a state of latency, given an independence and a state of, and a sense of truth independently by itself, then these involved principles do not have the full right to express themselves in their native consciousness and power. So what they do is, since they are involved, they press on this other modality, the modality of matter, for example, to create approximations in matter that will house life. These approximations will be the various mutations from below, but at a certain point, the approximations reach a certain kind of adequacy where something from above can precipitate an archetype of its own kind in matter. That is the intervention from above. So it's this double process which is involved in the, you know, evolution of forms and of consciousness in the ignorance.
Yeah, thank you, Debashida. What are you going
to say? No, I wanted to ask if this is the theory of intelligent design.
No,
this is not the theory of intelligent design. Theory of that, you know, the old debate was entirely between creationists and evolutionists. But theory of intelligent design has entered this particular debate lately, relatively lately. But intelligent design sort of hung around the peripheries of this debate for a long time, actually. Only it didn't voice itself because, you know, the biblical notion was so strong. Intelligent design is essentially saying that the world is too perfect to have come about through random processes. Life has got very low probability of existence in this tremendously vast universe, which is otherwise so sterile. And the complexity of life that has developed over here is something which evidences some sort of a power of design, intelligent design. It's sort of intelligence at work in picking out the sort of, the loading the dice, in other words. So intelligent design is another version of the clockwork universe, which even Newton believed in. Newton believed in a world which was created by God because that world was so perfect, so harmonious. In a way, it is, it's, you know, the Spinoza's argument, and, you know, ultimately even Einstein is, sort of somebody who believes in God from that point of view, that the perfection, the intuition of perfection and orderedness of this universe gives evidence of an intelligent maker. So that in biology becomes the argument of intelligent design. But intelligent design says nothing about the process by which evolution takes place.
So, when we say, going back to the previous thing, when we say an intervention from above, so then we really mean some kind of a transcendental acting on the universe, do we?
Yeah. Basically, what he's saying is whatever is involved in the principle of matter is also present in a kind of non-involved state, in a native state, in other words. An involution is some particular property of consciousness that is subject to another property of consciousness. It's within it and subject to it. But it may also, if it is involved, then it must also exist elsewhere in its own right. It's like, you know, a foreigner in a country. Say you're a foreigner in another man's land. Evidently, you're a foreigner. Either you're a freak or you have another country in which there are more people like you. See? So if it's not a freak, if there is enough consistency to it to emerge in some universal fashion, that means that there is some plane in which is its native plane, so to say. That is the idea of the intervention from above. The idea above over here is not necessarily transcendental or divine. The divine or spiritual planes would be some kind of an above, but any plane which is outside and, you know, not subject to the principle of matter in its own right would be some kind of an above.
Yeah, okay, so it's a relative above that keeps... Yeah, very, very nice.
But of course, the above idea also is, you know, I mean, relative above also, in a sense, does point to a gradation of ascension. That's why the whole chapter is called Ascent and Integration. Because there is a higher and higher properties. There is a sense of, I mean, you can see the modalities of being and consciousness that are expressing. And when we take them for what they are, we realize that each modality that has expressed is a greater gradation of consciousness, a more fuller representation of consciousness.
Yeah. So in many ways, it seems that this chapter, this Ascent and Integration, is really going into the heart of this Sri Aurobindo's evolution, Sri Aurobindo's take on evolution, correct?
But, yeah, it is one of those. It is one of those, definitely one of those chapters that goes into the heart of Sri Aurobindo's take on evolution.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Devashishtha. So, I mean, if there are no more questions, I guess we can start.
Devashishtha, I have one quick question about understanding the evolution of consciousness, of a particular gradation of consciousness, let's say human consciousness with time. For example, the general observation is from past to now, people are like less conscious in it as a whole. Even historically going back, like the concept of yugas, Krita Yuga, where there is complete truth consciousness, to again Treta Yuga, Dwapara Yuga, and all these things, there seems to be some sort of degradation than any evolution, at least. Can you comment on that? Like, how do we, it is from the existence point of view, if material evolution is adaptability and existence, that is easier to understand. But this evolution of consciousness, even without even talking about consciousness of different animal to human, if we were to take the human consciousness with time, with respect to time, if anything, it seems to be degrading. It doesn't look like it is an ascent, it is a degradation, more or less.
Yeah, actually, that's another entire area or another entire debate, so to say, that really hasn't entered the field sufficiently. But you see, there we come up with two kinds of theories. One is the theory, as you said, of the yugas and a kind of a devolution.
Yes.
From a Satya Yuga down to the obscuration of truth or dharma through the ages, and ultimately kind of an age of adharma or Kali Yuga, but leading upwards to an age of another Krita Yuga. And on the other hand, you have the linear progression of evolution, which is talking about the fact that if there is an evolution in human beings, it is more a kind of an anthropological movement from savages and primitive people to the point where we are civilized and we have this great material and technological civilization in which we find ourselves today. So we have these two models, one may say, and it's very interesting that Sri Aurobindo sort of makes use of both of them. And it's particularly in one particular passage in the human cycle where he foregrounds this whole idea. He's talking about the fact that they both coexist, that when we talk about these yugas, we are actually talking about something which is happening within this ascent itself. That is that right in the beginning, we are talking about a Satya Yuga, but the Satya Yuga is not something experienced by the mass of humankind. The mass of humankind is at a relatively primitive stage, but within them, there are a few Gnostic beings, beings who have advanced almost to the end. It's like there is a line in Savitri, in the beginning is prepared the close. So it's almost like right from the beginning, some beings are there to plant the seed of the end of the cycle. Those are the people who give you the Satya Yuga, so to say. But whatever it means, however it expresses itself, the way in which it manifests itself by controlling the environment and humanity at large becomes deformed over time. So that's how the Veda gets lost, so to say. The Veda gets obscured, and you get succeeding generations or succeeding ages that are working from Shruti to Smriti. You see that there is a fall, and they're reinterpreting. The age of interpretation rather than the age of direct revelation intervenes. And that ultimately leads to a point where almost the root of knowledge is lost, which was seeded in a rather primitive humanity by a much higher form of humanity. But on the other hand, there is an assimilation of this that has caused the general mass to progress. And that progression in the general mass has reached a point where it can receive another intervention from above.
Slightly orthogonal question. So the earlier the discussion on evolution, everything that would be from the perspective of planes and parts of the being, the physical mind working, correct?
Which part?
The physical mind.
Yeah, the physical mind. What would be the physical? I mean, what would relate to that?
When we talk of this evolution and the study of forms and how they are mutating and developing, all that is the physical mind at work, correct?
Yeah, but you know, prior to that also, prior to the physical mind, you're talking about within humanity?
Correct.
Within humanity? Mm-hmm. Yeah, even within humanity, you see, Sri Aurobindo makes the point that human mind has not changed all that much from its very beginnings. But the expression of human consciousness has changed. In other words, human consciousness, which integrates the various planes of the vital being as well as the properties of mentality, has changed in that in the mass we express much more rationality these days. I don't know whether that's really true, whether we do express more rationality.
Okay.
But, that he does seem to believe that, you see, for example, there is a certain degree of a stress towards coming to knowledge, to exercising the mind, and to gathering all kinds of laws of nature, laws of psychology of the human being, and all the sort of tremendous edifice of knowledge that we've, secular knowledge that we've built up, which in a sense is a kind of a pointer to the fact that mind is reaching its kind of limit, so to say, as a rational exercise. You see, now we may still be largely savages in our general behavior and in our, also in our, kind of national behaviors, but nevertheless, from the viewpoint of the expression of mind, you know, H.G. Wells had a brief history of the world, in which his last chapter is called Mind at the End of Its Tether. So that, you know, Will Durant also is talking about that. Contemporary philosophers are all acknowledging the fact that in a sense we've, you know, we have no further to go as far as mind is concerned. So that is a sign that, you know, there is a stress in the mind leading to something beyond.
So in a way, it seems that what they're really saying is that the vital mind has perfected itself, and there is no more excuses that it can find for the savagery.
No more excuses for its savagery. It can always find excuses for its savagery. You know, we're just experts at finding excuses for our savagery. But I think no, it's not so much the vital mind, it's more the, you know, the property of what they call enlightenment. You see, the whole modern age is built around this principle of trying to arrive at knowledge. But knowledge, of course, it's the whole thing is knowledge of the material world and of the human being. So that particular activity of the mind turned upon the world, the object, you know, of acquiring universal knowledge, that has reached more or less its culmination. You know, there's always more. We're always going to build even more sort of miniature supercomputers. Mm-hmm. But in principle, it's as if we've come to the point where we see that the trajectory that we have followed is like a kind of a chess game in which, you know, all the remaining moves are already mapped out as possibilities. Somewhere at some occult level of the human species soul, there is a sense that, you know, we've reached wherever we wanted to go. We can continue, but there is a certain kind of, you know, limit to our present self-definition.
Yeah, so in the recent OM, somebody was talking about how many traditions have in a way predicted the end of the world as we know it around this time. I mean, I'm not able to articulate it clearly because I don't remember exactly what it was, but it seems that many religions and prophets of the past have in some way predicted the end of the world around this time. I mean, is that something that you can relate to, or am I just being too vague here?
No. I think there is such a feeling that, you know, that many traditions of the past have prophesied some kind of a end to humanity. And what that end will be, nobody has very clearly kind of talked about. Some people think that it's going to be a great disaster and extinction of the human race. Some people feel that there's going to come some other new species. But, you know, it's not something that is very clear. I mean, what is more clear in modern times is also a similar kind of thing. It has more definition, at least, when Hegel talks about the end of history. And he's referring to the same thing. He thinks that the end of history is almost here. And for him, there is an evolution, and the evolution is the evolution of rationality, which is intrinsic or involved in matter. So, the idea of rationality, which is kind of, you know, evolving through a variety of stages and ultimately in the human brain, it becomes full-fledged. And in present-day society, it has kind of expressed itself in a very systematic way through our acquisition of knowledge of all kinds and our attempt to build systems that will give us the totality of understanding, and that we will possess this understanding in common as the human race. You see, we can envisage that. You know, today we may be, you know, having a variety of wars all over the world, but still, the ideal is still looming large, that science will bring us, universal happiness and the end to all our hunger and all our hospital needs. See, so that kind of a view of the end of history is a kind of a notion of the mind at the end of its tether, mind which still has the pride of its doing, but also knows that in a sense there is no further to go.
Okay.
So from that point of view, we may say that you see the expression of even things like the sort of cyberspace and the tremendous explosion of academic knowledge that is going on even as we speak. Thousands of PhDs are being written every minute, probably all over the world.
Uh-huh.
And the quickness with which this kind of information and knowledge that is being acquired can be received by people all over. This universalization of the goods of the mind, of mental goods, of knowledge work, as they call it, is something which, in a sense, is a huge thing which expresses some aspect of a higher mind in the human mind. It is definitely the pressure of the higher universal mind planes operating on the earth mind consciousness. It's also an invitation for individuals to rise into higher mental planes of consciousness. But that hasn't yet established itself as an ideal, because we don't think it's possible.
Devashish, is it really an invitation to explore the higher consciousness, or is it more of a confusion, so to speak, because of the speed at which you were expected to assimilate that information? Essentially, more likely than not, confusing, where there is not sufficient attention span to ponder or do tapasya on one particular thing, and more it is about the material knowledge and very little about the self knowledge. So it is very, very likely to confuse and disintegrate further than taking it higher, no?
No, you're absolutely right, because you see, from a certain point of view, we have created a kind of an encyclopedic world of knowledge, which is not the property of any individual, it's the property of humanity at large. But no individual has the capacity to receive it either, because we haven't put any attention to that. And we've created a system in which we have dwarfed our humanity. Sri Aurobindo has that edge to much of his writing, this sort of the anonymity into which we have thrust the human individual, the dwarfing of human consciousness by the modern world, by the forced, labor of, sort of conscripted ants trying to eke out a little knowledge that will ultimately multiply to the benefit of the whole of humanity. So that certainly I agree with you, but at the same time, it is a kind of sort of a reverse phenomenon where, there is a certain kind of need that can grow out of this. You see, comparative studies of all kinds are being conducted, and it is confusing, there's no doubt, but at the same time, there is some faculty within the human being that is also honing its own skills at acquiring this the knowledge that it needs out of all this confusion. Our search engines are getting better and better. So in some way, if the ideal or the aspiration arises, you will find what you need much quicker. But you're also right in the fact that we are not given the opportunity to, awaken any aspiration in us due to the compulsions that this system has created.
So is it the case that really even the unconscious evolution itself is accelerating?
Yeah, that would be, these things would be all aspects of an unconscious evolution that's accelerating. But as we know, unconscious evolution in the human case will not, you know, deliver the goods. It has to be a conscious evolution. So at some point, we have to rise out of this anonymity, rise out of this compulsion, and create conditions under which whatever has been generated or developed is the property of individual growth of consciousness.
I remember reading in some of the letters in which Sri Aurobindo says even any knowledge acquired from outside by reading even of his own books, all that is good, but finally that the knowledge has to come from within you and you have to learn from yourself. So in a way it seems that while this if I apply to this case, then all this knowledge that has been acquired by humanity as a whole, how valuable is it for like a person doing the yoga for himself? I mean, not for himself, I mean, trying to ascend himself.
Well, I think it's very valuable in the mass because you see, the problem is, I mean, the value of all external knowledge is, you're right, it's all a crutch ultimately, but we need many crutches before we can actually throw away all these external aids and find the knowledge within. So, you know, otherwise there's all kinds of, as you can see, you know, Sri Aurobindo arrives once in a million years. Otherwise, you
yeah.
have so many lesser lights that you can get confused by.
Mm-hmm.
And they themselves are confused by their own inner, I mean, many of them have arrived at knowledge from within. But it is not the ultimate knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
It is not the, you know, the light of lights. And so confusion is not only outside us, but confusion is also ultimately inside us. How are we to shear our way through the inner confusion? We can only do it through both ways, through a process of clarification, purification, and transformation within, and a process of finding the right guidance from without.
Nice one, Devashishda. Yeah. So what you're saying is that even that inner knowledge, I mean, all inner knowledge is not the final inner knowledge, correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, you know, like I mean, we were talking about this recently, about the kind of, you know, the Vijnana Chatushtaya, where, and even otherwise in general, you know, the kind of three forms of knowledge that Sri Aurobindo is talking about, you know, the knowledge by external contact, the knowledge by internal contact, and the knowledge by identity. And these three are a gradation. We start with knowledge by external contact. We use our senses to acquire knowledge and we work on what we acquired through our senses. But at the same time, we have to constantly fine-tune our inner faculties, the inner mind, the inner intuition. Those are the forms of knowledge by inner contact. And then that becomes a pointer to the unveiled knowledge by identity. So it's a progression, but you know that progression has to be worked out in us through a aspiration and a constant purification.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very nice, Devashishda. Very nice.
Meera, can you start us off?
For if we look not at the scientific or physical aspects, but at the psychological side of the question, and inquire in what precisely the difference lies, we shall see that it consists in the rise of consciousness to another principle of being.
Are we reading it again?
The matter is fixed in the inconscient and inanimate principle of matter. Even if we can suppose that it has some reactions suggestive of life in it, or at least of rudimentary vibrations that in the plant developed into life, still it is not at all characteristically a form of life. It is characteristically a form of matter. The plant is fixed in a subconscious action of the principle of life. Not that it is not subject to matter or devoid of reactions that find their full meaning only in mind. For it seems to have sub-mental reactions that in us are the foundation of pleasure and pain or of attraction and repulsion. But still it is a form of life, not of mere matter, nor is it, so far as we know, at all a mind-conscious being. Man and the animal are both mentally conscious beings, but the animal is fixed in vital mind and mind sense and cannot exceed its limitations. While man has received into his sense mind the light of another principle, the intellect, which is really at once a reflection and a degradation of the supermind. A ray of gnosis seized by the sense mentality and transformed by it into something other than its source. For it is agnostic like the sense mind in which and for which it works, not gnostic. It seeks to lay hold on knowledge because it does not possess it. It does not, like supermind, hold knowledge in itself as its natural prerogative. In other words, in each of these forms of existence, the universal being has fixed its action of consciousness in a different principle, or as between man and animal, in the modification of a lower by a higher, though still not a highest grade principle. It is this stride from one principle of being to another quite different principle of being that creates the transitions, the furrows, the sharp lines of distance, and makes not all the difference, but still a radical characteristic difference between being and being in their nature. But it must be observed that this ascent, this successive fixing in higher and higher principles, does not carry with it the abandonment of the lower grades, any more than a status of existence in the lower grades means the entire absence of the higher principles. This hints the objection against the evolutionary theory created by these sharp lines of difference. For if the rudiments of the higher are present in the lower creation and the lower characters are taken up into the higher evolved being, that of itself constitutes an indubitable evolutionary process. What is necessary is a working that brings the lower gradation of being to a point at which the higher can manifest in it. At that point, a pressure from some superior plane where the new power is dominant may assist towards a more or less rapid and decisive transition by a bound or a series of bounds, a slow, creeping, imperceptible, or even occult action is followed by a run and an evolutionary shelter across the border. It is in some such way that the transition from the lower to higher grades of consciousness seems to have been made in nature.
That's good.
So, as you can see here, he brings out in this small paragraph, he brings out exactly to some extent what we were discussing, that the problem of the furrows, as he calls them, or the discontinuities between these gradations is due to changes in the modality of consciousness. And he puts it over there that it's the universal being. As he says over there, let's see where he says it. He says, in other words, in each of these forms of existence, the universal being has fixed its action of consciousness in a different principle, or as between man and animal, in the modification of a lower by a higher, though still not a highest grade principle. And then he points to the fact that nevertheless, you do have a kind of a connection between these different gradations of expression of consciousness. And that is due to the fact that the successive fixing in higher and higher principles does not carry with it the abandonment of the lower grades, any more than a status of existence in the lower grades means the entire absence of the higher principles. So it is this presence in the lower grades and in the higher grades of, in the lower grades of a higher consciousness and in the higher grades of the forms of the lower grade of consciousness, which allow for its transformation, that give the sense to the kind of evolution of consciousness rather than a kind of a totally different creation from different rungs of consciousness. There's something interesting over there, which is that he uses that word stride. It is this stride from one principle of being to another, quite different principle of being, that creates the transitions, the furrows, the sharp lines of distance, and makes not all the difference, but still a radical characteristic difference between being and being in their nature. Now, of course, the idea of a stride is a distinct step. And I find this interesting this time when it was being read, that to think of Sri Aurobindo's translation of some of the hymns of the Rig Veda that are talking about Vishnu and calling him the far striding Vishnu. It talks about the strides of Vishnu. And these strides of Vishnu, of course, later turn up in the Puranic story about the three steps that he takes. But this idea of the strides of Vishnu is very closely related to this evolutionary universal being that is moving from grade to grade of consciousness in its expression.
So is the stride there indicating, to me it seemed to indicate more of a continuity than otherwise, but it seems that you are saying that the stride represents really a discontinuity?
No, the stride actually bridges the notion of continuity and discontinuity, because there is a being that is striding, you see, that's taking the steps. That being is the continuity. But the steps are each separate or different, distinct steps. They're quantized steps. And therefore, there is a sense of discontinuity in the expression of that me.
Yeah, okay.
And then in the last paragraph that was read towards the end, he introduces that idea again in a very strong way of that, in fact, it almost reads like a kind of a description of punctuated equilibrium.
It definitely.
You know, and that, you know, it's that particular paragraph is really striking, because at that point when Sri Aurobindo was writing this, that kind of a fossil record was not even available, you know, and the kind of theory he's proposing here is exactly what, you know, of course it's still debated, because still there are gradualists and there are, you know, Darwinian evolutionists who kind of poo-poo the idea of punctuated equilibrium. But it's certainly a very, very prominent theory in a modern or contemporary evolution. And so as he says over there, you know, that about the transition, he says what is necessary is a working that brings the lower gradation of being to a point at which the higher can manifest in it. At that point, a pressure from some superior plane where the new power is dominant may assist towards a more or less rapid and decisive transition by a bound or a series of bounds. And then he gives the whole movement. A slow creeping, imperceptible or even occult action. So that slow creeping, imperceptible action is really a totally gradualist kind of argument. But then he says, is followed by a run and an evolutionary saltus across the border, a run. There is, in fact, that's exactly what punctuated equilibrium says, that when you look at the kind of fossil records, you find that in a very short period of time, there is a tremendous amount of activity of mutation closer and closer to that which will, you know, sort of make the transition. And then you start finding that full-fledged transition, that is the punctuation, otherwise equilibrium or equilibrated.
Devashishta, what does saltus mean?
Saltus means leap.
So, can we understand this thing, this entire concept of evolution as more of a internal phenomena in the practice of integral yoga, where
how many people are
the same things and same processes which apply at a macroscopic level will be applied at a microscopic level also, and just like they happen outside, they do happen inside also. Can we say that?
Yes, absolutely, we can say that. We can absolutely say that, because that is exactly conscious evolution. It follows the same principle, and that's why he says all life is yoga, because he's saying there that this evolutionary process is the yoga of nature, and this same process must be duplicated in the inner processes of the human individual and become a conscious yoga in our own evolutionary movement or transition.
So, for example, if I'm not able to relate to animal consciousness and evolution and all these ideas, I can internalize the thing and understand it as a completely an internal phenomena, and this is an explanation for that, right?
Yes, absolutely. This is an explanation for that, because as an internal phenomenon too, the whole basis of Sri Aurobindo's yoga is that double movement of aspiration and grace. Mm-hmm. And that presupposes that there is an involved consciousness that is aspiring inside us, that is intrinsic to us. Even before we become conscious of it, it is there. But it is covered over with all kinds of automatic processes. But either by its coming to closer to the surface, or through the action of the pressure from above, we find that there is a quickening of the whole movement. And that movement of aspiration calls the pressure from above as well. And the descent in the inner mind planes or inner vital planes of the influence of that higher pressure that causes an even greater aspiration. And it is the double action of these two that cause the evolution of consciousness to take place, the divine consciousness to take its steps, as it says, make its strides in us.
Yeah, also the beauty of it is we don't have to worry about the concept of time once you internalize it.
Yeah, very, very true. Time becomes, in fact, that is the meaning of time. The true meaning of time is subjective progression. The cosmic idea of time, which is based in the objective fact of the rotations and revolutions of the cosmos or of the earth around the sun, which actually give us the sense of an objective time, is also, one may say, a universal subjective automatism that has at its basis the movement of consciousness and its progression.
Devashish, could you talk about how the philosophers of the current ages and the biologists, these evolutionary biologists of the current ages, reconcile with each other?
Yeah, well, you have two possibilities. Actually, that's a very good question, because one possibility is that, you know, evolutionary biology itself becomes a kind of philosophy, and you know, Darwinian, you know, the sort of, you know, Darwinianism is itself a kind of a philosophy. And then you have molecular biologists who have written philosophy. You know, you have Jacques Monod, for example, who has written a book called Necessity and Chance, where he looks at, you know, the processes at the, you know, microbiological level, and you know, studies whether there is order there, whether there is probability there, whether there is, you know, just random mutation there, etc. And then you have, you know, the whole field of philosophy, say from the 19th century, there has been this anthropism shift where the word philosophy, which is basically another word, another name for science, you know, sort of created a split, you know, between what was earlier called metaphysics and what became science. And a whole bunch of people started, you know, saying the legitimate field of philosophy is only materialist or natural philosophy. And so that created a rift in the world of philosophy, where those who wanted to hold on to the independent, you know, sort of status for philosophy, had to say that there is, you know, something other than our dependence on matter that has to be given its independence. So in terms of evolutionary philosophy, those are the people, you know, the field of philosophy or philosophers are the ones who in some sense have taken a stand against the purely materialist idea of evolution. They are the ones who have talked about either some kind of creative power within nature or some kind of divine intervention, or because they are the ones who, like Sri Aurobindo, I mean, are in a similar vein, have said that evolutionary biology has had no sort of acknowledgement for the evolution of consciousness or for the phenomenon of consciousness. And we could insist that consciousness is just an epiphenomenon of matter, but that there is no necessity to believe that. You see, that's also a faith, that's also a belief. So that's where philosophers have taken their stand. And, you know, as I said, I mean, philosophers of evolution have also, in the Western tradition, you know, made their voice quite strongly felt all the way back from Hegel and even before him to contemporary philosophers or modern philosophers like Whitehead, Henri Bergson, people like that, who are also evolutionary philosophers.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry to go back on the somewhat of tangential topic of this concept of yugas and the choice, the individual choice. Can you just comment upon, you once mentioned that there is more choice given with respect to time, and that is the real progression, and real opposites are pitted against each other with real choices. And can you just elaborate on that? I want to know, like, how that is. I wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah, because you see, I mean, for example, we talk about a perfect age. A perfect age can be achieved in two ways. Either it can be a perfect age because everybody follows some rule or law of perfection without thinking about it or without having any choice in the matter. And it can also be a perfect age because it is chosen by people. You know, people have exercised their will in choosing some principle of harmony. So the idea of the difference between a Satya Yuga and a Krita Yuga, a Satya Yuga, which is an age of gold, age of truth, and an age of fulfillment, which is a Satya Yuga come around to a higher spiral, is in this fact of either a certain kind of a principle is native to some people, or it is imposed on some people and they don't even think about it. And then they arise to a choice in which they accept it. So you see, we can think about, say, a society in which there are some people, I mean, this whole idea is it's a very interesting one, sociologically speaking. And there is a kind of a very famous contemporary social philosopher who has talked about the idea of doxa, D-O-X-A, doxa. And what by doxa he means is that, you know, societies, let's say India was never invaded by either Muslims or British or anybody from the outside, we would just have our own names for God, we would have our own customs, our own beliefs, and we would believe in those things forever, right? Now, those beliefs may be true, but still they are representations of a certain kind, and we wouldn't even know that other representations are possible. If those representations are given to us by the wise, by the sages, by the people who have received them as revelations from above, it would be sufficient for us to believe those particular forms that are given to us. But nevertheless, they are just forms. They are forms in which something higher is expressing, and through our blind acceptance of those forms, we find that we express a certain perfection. However, human nature is such that we are seeded with the knowledge of good and evil. In other words, that's what the Christians call the original sin of eating of the fruit of good and evil, which is the power of choice. And so sooner or later, that particular system or setup where we have blindly accepted the law of perfection, the law of dharma, is broken by some kind of, you know, transgression, either from within or from without. As soon as an invasion of somebody who doesn't believe your theories happens, immediately you are faced with the fact that what you believed so long is relative. It is not absolute. So then you have to contend with, am I going to continue believing this, or am I going to throw it away, or am I going to arrive at a choice of believing? We have these three possibilities open. And that's why he says that doxa bifurcates into orthodoxy and heterodoxy. Orthodoxy is religion. It is the policed condition of establishing a certain kind of custom or law of behavior as right. We move from a state in which we didn't have any choice to a state where we are being given a choice, but we are told that this is the right choice. See. On the other hand, we may choose not to follow orthodoxy, in which case we either reject it and choose something else, or we choose it with full knowledge. See. That is the difference. Now, in this increase of choice, there are two things happening. One is that the older order is breaking down, because there is the choice to choose against the order. And the other is that the power of choice itself is enabling us to come to an individual fulfillment which can actually assert a kind of an integrality of being. That is the fulfillment, eventual fulfillment of the age of truth, going through the age of individuality. See, that's why Sri Aurobindo goes through the ages in his own way, as a symbolic age, which then moves to a typal age and moves to a conventional age, an age of individualism, and finally an age of fulfillment or of integrality.
Thank you. So we can think of Kali Yuga as or the present age as the age of individuality leading towards the age of fulfillment, right?
Yes, yes. That's the Sri Aurobindo's view of the matter.
Thank you, Devish. So that fits into the evolution very well.
Yes, it does. It leads to a conscious evolution.
Conscious evolution.
You know, both at an inner level of the individual as well as at a universal level, because this whole thing has to be also a universal power at work. The whole species has to be guided by something which is pushing, on the one hand, towards the fragmentation of choice, on the other hand, towards the integration of choice.
Shall I read the next one?
Yeah.
In fact, life, mind, supermind are present in the atom, are at work there, but invisible, occult, latent, in a subconscious or apparently unconscious action of the energy. There is an informing spirit, but the outer force and figure of being, what we might call the formal or form existence, as distinguished from the immanent or secretly governing consciousness, is lost in the physical action, is so absorbed into it as to be fixed in a stereotype self-oblivion, unaware of what it is and what it is doing. The electron and atom are in this view eternal somnambulists. Each material object contains an outer or form consciousness involved, absorbed in the form, asleep, seeming to be an unconsciousness driven by an unknown and unfelt inner existence. He who is awake in the sleeper, the universal inhabitant of the Upanishads, an outer absorbed form consciousness which, unlike that of the human somnambulist, has never been awake and is not always or even on the point of waking. In the plant, this outer form consciousness is still in the state of sleep, but a sleep full of nervous dreams, always on the point of waking, but never waking. Life has appeared. In other words, force of concealed conscious being has been so much intensified, has raised itself to such a height of power as to develop or become capable of a new principle of action, that which we see as vitality, life force. It has become vitally responsive to existence, though not mentally aware, and has put forth the new grade of activities of a higher and subtler value than any purely physical action. At the same time, it is capable of receiving and turning into this new life values, into motions and phenomena of a vibration of vitality, life contacts, and physical contacts from other forms than its own and from universal nature. This is a thing which forms of mere matter cannot do. They cannot turn contacts into life values or any kind of value, partly because their power of perception, although it exists, if occult evidence is to be trusted, is not sufficiently awake to do anything but dumbly receive and imperfectly react, partly because the energies transmitted by the contacts are too subtle to be utilized by the crude inorganic density of formed matter. Life in the tree is determined by its physical body, but it takes up the physical existence and gives it a new value or system of values, the life value.
So here we see that he's talking about, as he has pointed out, two kinds of evolution that are going on. One is an evolution in forms, in the form existence, as he says. And the whole idea of form existence, the very word form itself, the word formal, for example, has to do with objectivity, objectivizing. Objectivizing means to treat as something other than, to make a distinction, a duality between that which observes or that which does and that on which is done or that which is observed. So for this kind of a duality to occur in its completeness, we must have something which is completely objective. In other words, which is completely form existence, as he says there. A purely formal of form existence. This form existence is what the principle of matter manifests. Therefore, it is a special tapas of chit. It is a special concentration of consciousness, whereby Brahman takes on the appearance of pure form existence. The purity of form existence can only be maintained through a certain divorce between that existence and the existence of consciousness within it. That is what he is calling the inhabitant within, which is so completely separated from its own involvement in form that there is no effect felt of consciousness on form. They seem to be totally two different things. This is the very root of the duality which ultimately is going to be experienced in Sankhya and classed as Purusha and Prakriti. The basic or basis of nature, of Prakriti, its rule of Prakriti, is the materiality of form consciousness, of form existence rather, not even consciousness, pure existence as matter, as form. So now, within that, however, the consciousness that is present can gradually cause a uninvolvement of the consciousness that is involved in form. So the sleeper wakes up. The internal inhabitant influences the form existence. And this is the transition he's talking about from matter to life. It's very interesting. Two things caught my attention here. One is that in this particular paragraph, he describes this transition in certain terms that he's going to repeat in the very first page and first canto of Savitri. He uses the phrase somnambulist world over there. And we can look at that first canto of Savitri. Where he's saying, he's he's talking about the earth, and he's talking about the awakening of consciousness. And you see, he's also using that phrase there, which he's taking from the Gita, and even earlier from the Upanishads. He's saying, he who is awake in the sleeper. And here you see, he says, firstly, he has that idea where he says, a mute, featureless semblance of the unknown, repeating forever the unconscious act, prolonging forever the unseen will, cradle the cosmic brows of ignorant force, whose moved creative slumber kindles the suns and carries our lives in its somnambulist world. A somnambulist is a sleepwalker. And the somnambulist world he's talking about here is that exactly what he's talking about in this particular passage too. The action of automatism preserved in the form existence of pure matter. Then he's talking in the next few lines, he is talking about the influence of this in the entire cosmos, in this enormous sprawl of space and its multitudinous heavenly celestial bodies. We find the earth has a slightly different status of consciousness within it. That status of consciousness has not yet awoken mind, but it has awoken a action of consciousness in its form existence, which is the action of dream, a kind of subjectivity. And so he goes in the next few lines, athwart the vain, enormous trance of space, its formless stupor without mind or life, a shadow spinning through a soulless void, thrown back once more into unthinking dreams, earth wheeled, abandoned in the hollow gulfs, forgetful of her spirit and her fate. So here you see he's going to describe the plant almost in those terms. In the plant, this outer form consciousness is still in the state of sleep, but a sleep full of nervous dreams, always on the point of waking, but never waking. Life has appeared. So here we find that there is a certain kind of a transition that is occurring, and this transition is one in which the inner inhabitant that he's talking about, this particular spirit or consciousness within, is having some kind of an effect on the form existence, giving it a new modality of nature being, a new consciousness of its own nature. And that is how the evolution of forms and the evolution of consciousness are in essence related. That's the point he's trying to bring out here.
I noticed he used the word informing in an interesting way, or rather used the root of it.
There is an informing spirit. That's the one you're thinking about?
Yeah, like forming inside.
Yes, yes. Thank you.
also life in a way is being awake, isn't it?
Yes, it's the beginnings of the stirring of our conscious existence, or of awakening of the sleep of matter, you may say, of the corpse. You know, that's why, you know, shava, that sort of corpse-like condition of matter, and life, which is awakening from the sleep, you know, or living from the dead. It also gives us that sense of, you know, I mean, he uses that term, full of nervous dreams.
Yes.
And in that again, and you see those avasthas, you know, the sort of pure materiality is the basis of Jagrat. And you start getting the beginning of the worlds of Swapna expressed within the world of Jagrat, starting from the plant life.
Buddha means the one who is awake, right?
Buddha, yes. Prabuddha.
What does Prabuddha mean?
Prabuddha is the same one who is awake, who has, whose buddhi has become complete, has found its root. The intelligence, the pra gives a, it gives a sense of, you know, of emphasis, fully. You know, sort of intelligent or enlightened. The principle of light, which is the basis of the intelligence, has become achieved or has become realized.
Debashita? Oh, sorry, Sita, go on.
No, actually, I wanted to ask about explaining. The second half of this paragraph, where why matter cannot really create life, he gave an argument. Can you please explain that? I did not understand that. Why matter by itself is powerless or very weak in receiving? He explained there. Can you please explain that one? I did not understand that part of our logic.
Oh, basically, the essence of this paragraph is that there is an inner inhabitant that has a certain kind of a relationship with the nature consciousness, or with what he's calling the form existence, and that particular relationship is a radically different one between matter and life. Though there is a form existence in both cases, and there is an inner inhabitant both cases. But what we find is that because that inner consciousness is there, in latency, everything that is achieved at one level can be achieved at the other. But in reality, its nature is not sufficiently developed to give it those values that another kind of relationship between inhabitant and nature can give. So that's why he's talking about what happens to life. He says it has become vitally responsible to existence, though not mentally aware, and has put forth a new grade of activities of a higher and subtler value than any purely physical action. At the same time, it is capable of receiving, that is, firstly to put forth means to express, and then to receive is to receive the impress of similar activities from around it. It is capable of receiving and turning into these new life values, into motions and phenomena of a vibration of vitality, life contacts and physical contacts from other forms than its own and from universal nature. This is a thing which forms of mere matter cannot do. They cannot turn contacts into life values or any kind of value, partly because their power of reception is not sufficiently awake to do anything but dumbly receive and imperceptibly react, partly because the energies transmitted by the contacts are too subtle to be utilized by the crude inorganic density of formed matter. So that is it. It's basically the nature force is not conscious enough. The relationship between the form existence and the secret conscious inhabitant is not one in which there is sufficient reciprocity between the two. It maintains itself in a certain kind of sleep, in an involvement. That is, the involved consciousness remains involved. It doesn't, has not evolved sufficiently. Though that particular phrase that he says, although it exists, if occult evidence is to be trusted. And here he is making reference to the fact that actually there is a sense of feeling even in material things. There is a consciousness in material things. And if one can act upon that consciousness with sufficient amount of power, then that consciousness can express itself too. That's why he's talking about two things. He's saying that nature force itself is not awakened enough. And the power that acts upon the inner consciousness from around it is not strong enough to cause it to wake up the nature of the consciousness that's in it. But it also points to the possibility that somebody with a strong enough consciousness, which is what the mother was doing all the time, interacting with material things, can wake up the conscious force in it and communicate with that. So that is the occult evidence that he is referring to there.
Debashista, I wanted to ask you about when he's talking about this nervous energy, nervous system. So in plants, what does that mean?
In plants, elsewhere he's talking about chitta. See, he's saying that chitta is already present in the plant. It is present as the mental element in the vitality of plants. Mm-hmm. So there is a certain kind of mentality there, but that mentality is not sufficiently free from the vitality, though it lends to it its sense of these, what he calls these subconscious dreams at the vital level. But it also gives it the basis of pleasure and pain, of certain types of reactions that are ultimately going to be experienced much more clearly in the mental existence mm-hmm. of the sense-formed being.
So can we say that in man, the nervous system uses a more sophisticated mechanism, like it uses electricity to communicate, whereas in plants, it doesn't use electricity, it might just use some other mechanism, which is more slow, sleeping.
Yeah, a developed nervous system is certainly a kind of a higher grade of the operation of mental energy. In vitality, the mental vital, you may say, interface is manifest through a nervous system. In plants, it is not that there is no electric activity. There is electric activity that takes place within plants as well, but it is not developed in the sense of an entire system, like the nervous system.
And obviously when Sri Aurobindo is talking about these things about plants, it's by knowledge, by identity. It's not that he is deriving his conclusions after Jagdish Bose's experiments.
Oh yeah, yeah. He does occasionally refer to Jagdish Bose's experiments in places, as for example in the synthesis of yoga. But here he is actually also referring to occult experience, occult evidence. So, also in general, he is drawing directly on his own knowledge knowledge by identity is knowledge of these things.
So, do plants and animals also have subtle bodies like humans have?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, there will definitely be a subtle body, but the subtle body may not be as organized as in the human being. Because in the human being, the subtle body at its absolute base, there is a psychic being. While here too, there is a being, it's the psychic entity. And also, there is a certain kind of a subtle form of the plant or of the animal.
So using Killian photography, they can see the subtle body of humans, right? Or it is
that
something
I'm not,
else?
I don't know. I mean, they make the claim that it is the aura that they see.
Oh, which is different from the subtle body.
It would be like an energy body or an energy diagram, so to say, of the radiation of maybe the vitality and its qualities.
Oh, I see. Shall we read the next one?
Yes.
Yeah, let's read one more. Mm-hmm.
Lopa, can you read?
Yeah. The transition to the mind and sense that appear in the animal being, that which we call conscious life, is operated in the same manner. The force of being is so much intensified, rises to such a height as to admit or develop a new principle of existence, apparently new at least in the world of matter, mentality. Animal being is mentally aware of existence, its own and others, puts forth a higher and subtler grade of activities, receives a wider range of contacts, mental, vital, physical, from forms other than its own, takes up the physical and vital existence and turns all it can get from them into sense values and vital mind values. It senses body, it senses life, but it senses also mind, for it has not only blind nervous reactions, but conscious sensations, memories, impulses, volitions, emotions, mental associations, the stuff of feeling and thought and will. It has even a practical intelligence founded on memory, association, stimulating need, observation, a power of device. It is capable of cunning, strategy, planning. It can invent, adapt to some extent its inventions, meet in this or that detail the demand of new circumstance. All is not in it a half-conscious instinct. The animal prepares human intelligence.
I think this is a very, very powerful and, you know, very wonderful paragraph. And maybe we should take it up in greater detail next time. Again, this is an evidence of Sri Aurobindo's amazing knowledge by identity with all these various levels of and beings, and it immediately draws to mind the experiments that he was carrying out with animals in the Record of Yoga, where he could really enter into identity with them and even experience whatever they were experiencing. And he gives us the whole gamut of the experiences at the animal level, what is possible in the animal mentality, in the vital mentality, as he puts it over there. And you know, we can maybe sort of take this up again next time and inform it with some other readings, if any of you would like to, either from the Record of Yoga or from some of the other writings of Sri Aurobindo or the mother, on this kind of you know, the powers of the animal consciousness.
Is there some particular chapter or topic or something you can refer that we can read for the week?
Not really. I'm not sure myself. I would look at the Record of Yoga. There's a lot over there where he's actually talking about the... And then there's things in his conversations and his writings, but mainly in both those conversations, the early and later conversations, where he talks about animals and about the power of mentality in animals, to what degree it is developed, what they can do and what they can't. And it may be, you know, worthwhile doing a little research and trying to see what we can come up with. And I'm sure there's things in the mother's writings. That book called The Mother's Vision, which George von Breckham has compiled, you know, carries a very wide gamut of her views on a variety of things, including, I think, plant and animal life. And it might be useful to look at that too.
Yeah, and in one place, I think he has, Sri Aurobindo or mother, they've both commented on dreams of animals and what they could signify. So that too could be one topic in this context.
Yes, that would be very nice, yes.
Let's end with a brief meditation.